James Sexton is a high-powered, hard-hitting divorce lawyer. He's facilitated the demise of 1,000-plus marriages and counting. And along the way, he's observed the things that people typically do to ruin them. In his new book, If You're in My Office, It's Already Too Late, A Divorce Lawyer's Guide to Staying Together, he leverages what he's learned over the last two decades to provide insight and wisdom from the front lines of divorce to keep you out of his office and to improve your relationship. Again, the name of the book is If You're in My Office, It's Already Too Late, and we welcome James Sexton to the roundtable this morning. James, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I'm a fan. Thank you.
Well, thank you. So what brought you to put these ideas together, ultimately to help people avoid your office?
Well, you know, it wasn't a desire to put myself out of business, but it really was just a matter of having, you know, been working to facilitate the demise of unhappy marriages for the better part of two decades. I really got to a point where I started to think about that, you know, there's a certain kind of wisdom that I think you start to see, you know, watching so many relationships fall apart. You know, it's like a mechanic who sees, you know, cars once they're broken down. You really can reverse engineer it into a knowledge of what, you know, where do things break down? What are the predictable ways? What are the patterns that things can break down? And, you know, it really revealed itself over time. I really started out writing a book of just war stories and sort of salacious, you know, slow down for the car crash kind of stories. But as I was writing it, I started to realize that there was a lot of places where, you know, you could see trends and traits and things that people could have done to probably get out of the way before the car crash. And that's kind of how it came about.
So let's talk about why people usually end up in your office. Some of the common reasons being what?
Well, you know, I think it's a lot of little things that add up to big things. You know, there's no single raindrop that's responsible for the flood, but the flood's made up of lots of little raindrops. And you know, people will come into your office and say, well, we're splitting up because my husband's sleeping with his secretary. And, you know, it's a pretty good reason to be in my office and getting divorced. But if you really start looking at it, you start to see that the disconnection between these people started a long time before that. You know, Tom Wolfe in The Bonfire of the Vanities, one of the characters says something about, you know, how did he go bankrupt? And he says, well, two ways, very slowly and then all at once. And that's kind of how it works with divorce. You know, people very slowly start divorcing each other, and then all at once they actually end up going through a divorce. So to me, the main reason people divorce is not a sexy one. It's that they disconnect. You know, that we come together in relationship, we connect, we find someone that there's things about them that are compelling to us, there are things about us that are compelling to them, and there's a deep connection. But that connection slowly unravels, you know, because the world is somewhat antagonistic to that connection. And even things we love, like our children, you know, can be antagonistic to that connection. And if you don't maintain that connection, it starts to fall apart.
The point, or one of the points that you make in the book, is that often people are not honest with themselves about what's going on in their head, in their hearts, and they're also not honest with their partner. And
yeah.
And or, right? So
yeah, I mean, the most dangerous lies are the ones we tell ourselves, you know.
So that honesty is a big part of the puzzle.
Yeah, it's honesty, and I would take it even further and say it's a really candid kind of honesty. It's being honest with yourself about the things you don't want to look at, you know, and being honest with your partner. Look, I think a lot of us are just trying to get through the day, and the world is not easy to navigate for any of us necessarily. And I think at the end of the day, the last thing you want to do is sit down with your partner and go, hey, you know, today was okay with you and I, but here's some things that could have made it better, or here's some things you did that, you know, that were hard for me or that disconnected me from you. But I think that if we don't do that, we really do start to fray and start to lose the connection. So the book, a lot of the practical stuff I suggest in there is ways to do that aren't so kind of onerous or aren't so miserable or that don't increase the disconnection but actually try to bring us back together as people.
Is there a possibility in that scenario that you just gave of overthinking this?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is absolutely, and there's a risk of paying too much attention. But you know, I guess in the gamble of mindfulness and being too mindful versus the gamble of being oblivious potentially, I would rather put my money on being overly mindful, because the worst case that's going to happen is your partner might say to you, hey, you know what, it's not that big of a deal, or, oh, you know, I wow, really, that was on your radar because it kind of wasn't on mine. And you know, yeah, sometimes our emotions are like clouds and they just pass with time. But in my experience, you know, with the divorce rate being 53% of marriages ending in divorce, and then if we're just vaguely conservative and say, well, let's say another 10%, although it's probably much more, just stay together for the kids or just stay together for financial reasons. Now we've got something that fails 63% of the time. That's huge. That's a huge number. I mean, you know, if there was a car that the brakes failed 63% of the time, you'd never buy that car. You know, so the idea here is that if you're going to err, maybe err on the side of too much closeness, too much connection, too much sharing of what you're feeling and thinking on a day-to-day basis, if that's going to be the thing that helps you not lose the plot of the story you're writing together.
You talk about this in the book, but you offer suggestions of what couples should do before they get married. A couple of things being what?
I think having a very honest conversation about what your day-to-day habits are is huge. I think that sometimes the things that bring people together also are the things that end up pulling them apart. You know, sometimes we're drawn to our opposite. You know, if I'm, you know, super tidy and super organized, you know, it might be fun and appealing to be with someone who's a little more spontaneous and a little more laid back. And I might reel them in a little bit, and they might kind of pull me out of my comfort zone a little bit. But ultimately, if you're building a life and a home with this person, that's going to start to really grate on you over time, you know. So I would say be very honest with a person about your day-to-day habits, because we think in these generalities and in these romantic sort of generalities, but we live in day-to-day life. And so what are your life habits with this person? What are your life goals with this person? I think that's a huge conversation. I think another really important conversation is having a conversation about the conversation. So when there are problems in the marriage, how should we approach it? How should we talk about it? Should I send you an email? Should I send you a text? Should I wait until things are really bad? Or should we talk about things right at the beginning? So I would talk to the person about when there is a problem, how does it work? Like when I sign up for an online service, I want to know, how do I get in touch with customer service? Sometimes I'll even call customer service to see how good it is before I sign up for the service, because I want to know, will I be able to get hold of someone if there's a problem? So kind of do the same thing in your relationship. And I guess I'd say another thing is I'm a big fan of talking about divorce from the day you're engaged or from the day you're dating. Because when you're talking about divorce, you're really talking about what's most important to you in a relationship and what do you expect this person to bring to the table. So, you know, when we're sick, when we get over being sick, we're the most mindful of our health we'd ever be, right? Like you get over being sick and you just go, oh, I'm so happy I don't feel sick anymore. You know, when you have, you know, someone pass away in your life, you're so mindful of life, you know, and how great you are to be alive and how happy you are that you're alive. Well, in the midst of divorce, thinking and talking about divorce, there's almost like a stoic philosophy there of like thinking about divorce makes you value the reality of marriage, and that marriage is not, you're not permanently gifting your love to someone. It's a loan. You're loaning your love to someone, and that loan can be canceled. So to me, talking about divorce from the beginning, about what are the kinds of things that would make us divorce, what are the things that are just deal breakers for each of us, that's a really important conversation to have, I think.
Is there not a risk in doing that, though, that you're also perhaps giving up too easy, in the sense that it's always, if you're talking about it, it's always on the table and perhaps is more readily available in the utility belt than it would be otherwise?
You know, I think that's a fallacy, because I think divorce is there. It's there anyway. So you're not doing anything. That's like saying, like, if I talk about how important it is to brush my teeth, I might get cavities more often because I'm more aware of cavities. I'm thinking more about cavities. I think the truth is that it makes way more sense to keep divorce there, because it's there. You can pretend it's not, but you're not helping yourself to pretend it's not there. I think that talking about it, not as a threat, but talking about it as a possibility. All marriages end. They all end. They either end in death or divorce, but they all end. And so you wouldn't say, well, I don't want to talk about estate planning because, you know, I don't want to think about the fact that someday I'm going to die. Well, that's crazy. You know, you're going to die someday. So have a conversation about wills, estates, you know, who would you want to care for your kids? You have to have that conversation. It's irresponsible not to. So it's the same thing. All marriages end. So have the conversation about, you know, how, if it ended by divorce, what would it look like? Why would that happen? What would we need from each other? Would we be able to try to have dignity and friendship in that situation? There's a lot to reveal about a person's personality by talking about how they would break up.
Are there fundamental differences and concerns and issues that come to your office from a couple that's been together 2, 3, 5, or those very itchy 7-year marks, or compared to a couple that's been together 25, 30, 35, 40 years?
Yeah, I mean, I think couples that have been together for what I would call an extended period of time, so 20, 30, 40, 50 years, you know, obviously you can't be together that long and not weather a lot of good and bad and loss and gain and all of those things. So certainly that is, there's a depth to that relationship that I think is really significant to people. And so when those bonds are broken and when those people are breaking up, there's definitely a difference in the emotional level. Sometimes that's a positive difference, meaning that these are like people who've been through the war together and they sort of have a respect for each other. And sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes there's a real animosity that can grow with resentment over such a long period of time. The idea of things happening on the sevens, you know, people always say the 7-year itch, those kinds of concepts, that's really, I think, a function of what's happening in people's lives on the sevens. So if you really think about it, you know, people marry. Maybe they have a year or two before they have kids, but then they have kids. And so what's the 7-year mark of marriage? They got a 5-year-old maybe, you know, or they have a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And that's a lot of strain. That's a lot of stress in a relationship. So, of course, that's a moment in the marriage where there's going to be stress and strain. What's the 14-year mark? Well, at the 14-year mark, you got 12-year-olds. So now you're getting into middle school years. You're getting into more complex terrain. What's 21? 21, the kids are off in college, right? If they're 17, 18, they're off in college. It's another splitting point. So if you think about the rule of the sevens, that really actually makes sense because it has to do with the life stages of people. It's not mathematical and it's not superstitious. It really just has to do with what's going on in people's lives and where there are tension points. And part of the idea of my book is to say to people, look, you're not doing yourself a favor by hiding from those tension points. You're better off bracing for them. You're better off putting together strategies to communicate about them, because then when they come, not if they come, when they come, you're ready.
James Sexton is our guest. The name of the book, If You're In My Office, It's Already Too Late, A Divorce Lawyer's Guide to Staying Together. We should point, you are a divorced divorce lawyer.
I am. I am a divorce lawyer and still a romantic.
So that makes you, I mean, you have, does that give you an experience that is helpful in your practice?
You know, I like to think it does. I was a divorce lawyer for over a decade before I got divorced. I'm very lucky. I my ex-wife is a lovely person, and I tell people that she's one of the many people in the world that I love that I wouldn't want to be married to, and she would probably describe me the same way. She'd say that I'm a person she loves and she wouldn't want to be married to. We have two wonderful sons who are both college age. We get along great. She's very happily remarried to a great guy, and so we have a really nice family, and you know, I'm very pleased to be able to tell you, and this isn't something a lot of people know, that a lot of divorces aren't unfriendly. You hear a lot about unfriendly divorces because they're fascinating. But the truth is, and by the way, the people that talk about their divorce a lot are usually people who are scarred by their divorce. You know, my divorce was one of the least interesting things that ever happened to me because it was two people who met when they were 17 that eventually it didn't work out, and they've stayed very close and they co-parent together. That's not very sexy. That's not really interesting. You know, it's more interesting if we're throwing things at each other. So, yeah, I think I learned a lot from being a divorce lawyer. I think I learned a lot about you know, love from getting divorced myself. But I think that, you know, everything can be a learning experience if it's approached the right way.
Speaking of scars, when did you get the tattoos? Was that during the marriage or after?
You know, I started getting them when I was 17.
Man, and you got a lot of ink there, buddy.
Yeah, it continued as a trend, I have to say. I joke with people it's the last remaining proof of my wayward youth. But yes, I have a lot. And I still get them from time to time. I still can't overcome the compulsion to get them.
And I know this because the picture on the book of the jacket photo, if you had just left your shirt sleeves down, we wouldn't know this. But you smartly rolled them up so we could see it.
And it's only a small amount of the real estate that you actually see on there. Actually, my entire back, most of my abdomen, I would say probably a good 80% of my body's tattooed. But yes, it's something, it was a well-kept secret for the first decade or so of my career. And then I reached the point in my career where I was established enough as a lawyer and I had a good enough reputation with judges and other lawyers that I thought, well, I can come out now if I have to as a tattooed person. So, but I will tell you a very funny thing that I actually, the first first time I had a public photo was in a magazine that done a profile of me, and the photographer said to me, oh, let's do one with your sleeves rolled up like you're working. And I said, oh, I can't do that because I have tattoos. And she said, oh, come on, let's do it. You know, the name of the photographer, Stacia Grossman, who was actually the photographer who did the jacket photo. And I said, all right, but these are just for me. Don't give them to the magazine. So she took them, and she actually said to me after they were all done, she said, look, those are some of the best photos. I think you should send them to the magazine. So I said, fine, send them to the magazine. And sure enough, they loved them. But I've had two or three very high net worth clients, one of which was a Fortune 50 company CEO, say, I hired you because of the tattoos. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, I have a lot of tattoos myself, and it's kind of nice to have like another tattooed professional. So it turned out to be a very solid investment to let people know.
Let us, before I let you go, get to just a couple of issues here that hurt marriages. You write in this book a lot about technology, and you believe that technology is really quite a disaster for a marriage.
Well, I think it has, you know, the potential to do good things, but no, I think currently the way we use Facebook, the way we use a lot of social media in particular, I single out Facebook, and at the time that I was writing the book, you know, they weren't quite as down for the count as they are right now. But yeah, I'm very critical of social media because I do see over the course of a 20-year career how with the rise of the use and ubiquity of social media, particularly Facebook, we see an increase in the number of cases where there's infidelity that was caused by people reconnecting with ex-boyfriends or girlfriends or, you know, people from their children's school who they connect with innocuously on Facebook with very, you know, very legitimate reasons to connect to the person, but then it slowly turns into, you know, something that's more nefarious or more antagonistic to a marriage. So yeah, I think these things have the ability, you know, like all technology, it's the Faustian bargain, you know, it creates problems and it solves problems. I think it's creating a lot of problems people don't want to talk about.
You also, and I think rightly, but you also talk about that it's very, very difficult to move past infidelity. I mean, again, you mentioned this, you know, if you're in my office, it's already too late. But that is, you make the point in the book that very, very few people that you've worked with in the many years that you've done this have gone to some sort of counseling and moved on and gotten over it.
Yeah, unfortunately that's true. And I make very clear in the book that, you know, I'm a skewed, you know, reporter because I'm someone who you come to when you have a contentious or difficult divorce situation. I'm sure there are people who never make it to my office that, you know, work through that. I guess you'd have to ask Esther Perel or any number of the other really great professionals out there who are talking about moving on from infidelity in ways that people can navigate that. But yes, in my experience, it's a very, very difficult thing to overcome. It's a sort of a death knell very often for a relationship. By the time people come to my office, in a 20-year career, really, I think I've lost, quote unquote, two or three clients to reconciliation, meaning that they actually left and they kind of put their guns away and they all moved on and lived happily ever after. And again, even of those couple of people, I really don't know if long-term they were successful or if they came to someone else. More often than not, what happens is people come in, they've discovered infidelity or they're engaged in it, and they, you know, say, well, we're going to go to counseling, and then they go away for a couple of months or a couple of weeks, and then they come back. That's why among divorce lawyers, we unfortunately but jokingly refer to marriage counseling as delaying the inevitable.
But you make the point in the book, too, that sex is incredibly important in nearly all marriages, because if it is not, then that often leads to the infidelity, which will inevitably bring you to your office.
Sure, sure. I mean, look, sex is the glue, and I think we all know that. It's what separates your spouse from a roommate or a really close friend. You know, sex is the glue, and if you start taking that away, what it tells me, what it teaches me, is the need we have for connection. You know, doing what I do for a living, part of the reason why I think it could make a romantic of you is you just see how starved people are for connection and love and to have someone who's their cheerleader. And so if you're not going to be your spouse's cheerleader, if you're not going to make your spouse or help your spouse feel desired or feel supported or feel loved or feel beautiful, with those little gestures, those little things you do when you're falling in love with someone and you're trying to have them fall in love with you, those little kindnesses, those little sort of courtesies, the way that you make them feel interested and interesting, when you stop doing that, people don't lose their need for that. They still need it. They're just not getting it, you know. And if people get hungry enough, they're going to eat. They're not going to stop eating. And so if you put your spouse in a position, for whatever reasons, whether they're good, bad, or neutral, your spouse is going to find that connection somewhere else.
How patient do you believe we should be in working on a marriage before we head to your office?
That's a great question. I mean, I would say that I think patience in a marriage is very important because the goal of a marriage should not be equality. The goal of a marriage should be equity. It should be fairness. You know, there are going to be times where your spouse needs more than you, and there's going to be times where you need more than your spouse. And the goal of a marriage is to look on the timeline and say, hey, you know, at the end of the day, at the end of this timeline, we were good to each other, and it was an equitable, it was a fair situation. So I would say that the sooner people start talking about any disconnection they start feeling from their spouse, the better. But once you start bringing someone like me into the mix, you know, I get paid to be paranoid, you know, so my job is when someone comes into my office to immediately start protecting them. And in some ways, I'm also a weapon. You know, I'm something that you point at someone and I'm there to pursue my client's goals. So I think getting to my office is not, you know, that one of the titles we kicked around when I wrote the book originally was If We're Talking, It's Too Late. And I actually said, you know what, that's not a good title because if you're talking to me, it's okay. But if you're in my office, it's too late. So when you're talking to your partner, when you're talking to your spouse, when you're looking at divorce and thinking about it as a possibility, I think you're still in a good place. But I think once you cross that barrier and come to my office and start talking about, okay, how do we actually, from an engineering standpoint, start dismantling this thing, then it's pretty far along.
You mentioned a moment ago about you're doing the best for your client when they come to you as a divorce lawyer. What ultimately are you trying to do? What should a client's goals be in working with you as a divorce lawyer?
I think the first thing that I try to get a client focused on right away is their post-divorce life. That a divorce is a punctuation mark in your life. You know, there are certain things that happen in your life that are so significant that they become a punctuation mark of sorts. You know, when there's when you didn't have children and then there's once you had children. There's when you weren't married and then there's when you were married. You know, there's like maybe in your lifetime, what, 5, 6, 7 punctuation marks, you know? When I moved to the West Coast, when I moved to the East Coast, big thing, you know? And so I try to get people focused on the fact that there's a place we're going, and it's a post-divorce life, and my job is to help be an architect of that and to help keep you focused on that, you know, keep you focused on where it is we want to go and what that destination should look like for you and look like for your children. And a lot of my job is just to help people, you know, keep people focused on the big picture, on the fact that if they have children, for example, that, you know, that they're going to have grandchildren with this person that they're divorcing. So they're stuck with this person. You know, a divorce is at best a knife fight in a closet. You know, it's a small space and the kids are in there. And if you start swinging at each other, you're going to hurt yourselves and you're going to hurt each other and you're going to hurt the kids. So, you know, keeping your focus on the big picture, keeping your focus on, you know, ending something with dignity, ending something with love if possible. And that's really how I conclude the book is I just say, look, it's hard to stay together. It's hard to break up. Whichever of those paths you choose, just try to be the best version of yourself possible.
The name of the book is If You're In My Office, It's Already Too Late, A Divorce Lawyer's Guide to Staying Together. The book is published by Holt. James Sexton is the author. James, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to be here. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, If You're In My Office, It's Already Too Late, by James Sexton, published by Holt. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.